Hello and welcome to our Sinton's Neurotrauma podcast series, where over the coming weeks we'll be talking to different people who are involved in the rehabilitation process and the multidisciplinary teams that we set up. My name's David Pritchard and I'm the head of marketing here at Sinton's. Now, we have recorded 5 of these podcasts in total, each lasting approximately 30 to 40 minutes, and we'll be bringing them to you over the coming weeks and months. Our speakers from Sinton's, partner and head of personal injury Mark Quigley, along with partner and neurotrauma lawyer Kate Oliver. Our special guest speaker today is Matt Nakaneski, who is a principal speech and language therapist at Speech Therapy Northeast. So without any further ado, straight over to Mark. Mark, good morning and over to you.
Matt, hello. Thank you so much indeed for joining us. This is
a series
of podcasts, and we are very much looking forward to hearing a little bit more about you and the role that you play within multidisciplinary teams as a speech and language therapist. Always best to start at the beginning. So let's just ask a few questions about you. Tell us a little bit more about you, Matt, and your journey to becoming a speech and language therapist. How did you get to be where you are today?
Oh, yeah, brilliant. Thanks for having me. Yeah, so I actually studied my degree back in Australia, if people are aware of my accent before they've heard this. But so I studied in Australia and qualified in 1999. Worked for a little bit back in Australia for about 18 months and then decided I had got the travel bug and wanted to come over to the UK and do some work and do some traveling. So came over to the UK in 2001, did quite a few locum jobs, predominantly up here in the Northeast. My first one was in Sunderland and then the rest were all throughout Newcastle. And then in about 2002, I was offered the chance to be sponsored to stay longer, which kind of scuppered my 2-year working holiday plan. So I was only supposed to be here for 2 years and I've just clocked up 21 years. So 21 years later, I'm still here. But was offered the chance to fill a vacancy at the neuro rehab unit here in Newcastle. So it was when we used to be at Hunter's Moor, which is now known as Walker Gate Park, or we moved to Walker Gate Park. So I had never really thought of doing that type of role as a speech and language therapist, and I think we'll talk about that maybe a little bit later. So I did that for 9 years. So I was there for 9 years at Hunter's Moor / Walker Gate Park. Then decided that I felt like I needed a little bit of a change from doing very, very intensive inpatient ABI rehab, which can be very intense at times. And then I joined the Durham and Darlington NHS Trust, and I was there for 8 years. And that role was a little bit, to start with, it was a little bit around sort of stroke rehab. But then I sort of moved into sort of a more of a general community caseload, which saw me take on a really varied caseload. So lots of different neurological conditions. So motor neurone disease, Parkinson's, multiple sclerosis, still some stroke rehab, dementia. And that was both managing swallowing difficulties and supporting communication. So I was there for about 8 years. Throughout that time, I was sort of gradually dropping my days within the NHS and was starting to take on a little bit more private work. And then in 2019, decided to make the big leap into full-time independent practice. Possibly not the best timing because the pandemic was just around the corner, but still here to tell the story. So that's always a good thing. For the last almost 3 years, I guess, have been working full-time independently and now run my own business, which has been great. And back sort of full circle, doing predominantly ABI rehab, but now with more of a community focus rather than the inpatient management stuff that I had done earlier on in my career. And I think that's it in a nutshell.
Well, that's fascinating. And in terms of the decision-making, Matt, was there a particular driver for you to decide to move away from the NHS service, which you'd been in for so long, into private practice? What was it about running your own business which most attracted you?
I mean, there's nothing better than being your own boss, I guess, in terms of being able to be a little bit more flexible with your time and just having that complete autonomy, really, and being able to do things, 100% the way that you would like to do things. And, there are understandably quite a few constraints that are there within the NHS and sort of, how long it might take to make some decisions to get things done. Whereas if you're working for yourself and you run your own company, you can sort of make those decisions relatively quickly. you know, probably not too controversially. I don't think I probably didn't feel like there was a great deal more career progression for me potentially within the NHS. I had done a management role in the past and didn't particularly enjoy that management role. So that would have been another option, would have been to go back into some sort of management role. Clinically, there wasn't that sort of many other options for sort of career progression. So yeah, so I'm always up for a challenge. So I thought that the next challenge for me would be to do full-time independent work and set up my own company.
And so far, is the challenge living up to your expectations?
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. It definitely is. You know, yeah, it's, and now that we've taken on quite a few associate therapists, sort of, I am sort of now taking on a bit more of a management role than a supervisory role, which is really good. It is a role I do like to do when the conditions are right. So yeah, no, definitely. And every day is a challenge and, you know, going into this, I didn't have a huge business head on my shoulders. So that's a skill that I've had to now learn. So that's been a challenge within itself, sort of, you know, getting your head around the sort of the business side of things as well. So yeah, definitely. It's a challenge, but a good challenge.
Still makes me feel really, really old when people say 1999 and it was 21 years ago, because I feel like 1999 was last year, not 21 years ago.
They were our heydays, Kate.
I know. You obviously mentioned setting up just before COVID. And I know a lot of what you do kind of pre-COVID was very much face-to-face. And so how did you find COVID and working remotely, presumably for large parts of it?
Yeah, and actually, I mean, I had always been a bit of a firm believer that sort of telehealth was always a really good option to consider, even sort of back in NHS days. So yeah, obviously COVID kickstarted that for everybody really, and you just had to adapt really quickly. So yeah, it was a challenge to start with. Most of our clients, we were able to move over to remote working, and it worked well. It worked well enough. I still don't feel it was ever as good as being able to do face-to-face work. And certainly some of our clients who were in sort of more residential care settings certainly struggled to access remote sessions. So you know, there was definitely a negative impact on those types of clients when we had to move to telehealth, regardless of how much we tried to do to try and support them moving to that sort of service delivery option. But then interestingly, sort of as restrictions lifted throughout the pandemic, we decided to give all of our clients the choice, you know, did you want to keep working remotely or would you like to go back to face-to-face? And I'd say probably close to 100% decided that they wanted to go back to face-to-face working. Mm. We still do some remote sessions, but yeah, it is now back to predominantly face-to-face work.
That's interesting. And so some of our listeners might know a lot about speech and language therapy, but some might not know very much about it at all. So I think it would be quite useful if you wouldn't mind just kind of telling us what a speech and language therapist is within the kind of remit of the MDT and how you come often to be involved. We spoke earlier, obviously, about the kind of open quote neuro at the beginning of your speciality and working with people with brain injuries. And I think that obviously adds an extra complex layer to it. It'd be interesting to hear about that.
Yeah, I think you're not wrong there in terms of, I think a lot of people probably misunderstand our profession a little bit or don't maybe realize the extent of the different sort of clinical areas that we cover or that we can specialize in. So yes, I'm actually really thankful for this opportunity to be able to explain our role a little bit more. I don't think it's helped by our professional title. So speech and language therapist. So that's what people will sort of hone in on. And most people hone in on to the speech side of things. So yes, obviously we do work with people who have had changes with their speech. So that could be that they might have sort of slightly slurred speech because of a motor problem, a muscle problem with their speech. Some people have what we call dyspraxia, where they sort of can't sequence the movements when they're trying to sort of articulate and form words. We also work with people who are disfluent, or people would think more of the words like a stutter or a stammer, often more of a sort of not necessarily a childhood condition, but actually some of our ABI clients, acquired brain injury clients, can acquire a bit of a stutter or a bit of a stammer. So that is certainly an area that we sometimes look at. So yeah, so the language side of things, which is the other part of our professional sort of title. So yeah, certainly we do work with people with language difficulties. We would describe them as having aphasia, and that became sort of more widely known a little bit earlier in the year when Bruce Willis's family came out and sort of explained that Bruce Willis was experiencing what we call aphasia. So Aphasia is any sort of difficulties using or understanding language. So expressing ourselves through using language, understanding information or language that's spoken to us, reading written information, or writing or spelling or typing information. So sort of those four areas of language. So that's another area that we work with. We work extensively with people with swallowing difficulties. But again, I think a large percentage of people probably don't know that we do that. It's not in our, It's not in our professional title. But yeah, we certainly work very much so with people with swallowing difficulties. And that includes assessing them. And we can access quite, nifty assessments that we can use to assess a person's swallow really objectively. Then we can help manage any particular difficulties that they're having to make sure that they're swallowing safely, but also look at rehabilitating their swallow and then trying to improve their swallow function. Again, thinking more of your clients with an acquired brain injury. Another area that we feel we've got a huge role in, and again, I don't feel that people necessarily kind of realize or appreciate that it's an area that we can work with. We call it working with people with sort of cognitive communication difficulties. So it's that crossover between a person who's experiencing some cognitive difficulties and then the impact that has on how they can communicate either effectively or even appropriately with other people. Another label we might use to sort of help people understand what we're talking about with that particular area would be a person's social communication skills. So how they are able to use their communication socially and how well they're interacting with other people. So that's a huge area that we work with, especially with the acquired brain injury population. I can't think of the stats off the top of my head, but the incidence rate for that particular area of difficulty is quite high with clients with an acquired brain injury, whereas research shows that actually referral rates to speech and language therapy for that particular condition are still often quite low. So it's an area that, I'm very keen to talk more about and explain to people, because it's a huge thing. Your ability to communicate and interact appropriately with other people is sort of fundamental to most of the things we do in our lives in terms of relationships, friendships, workplace relationships, education, so many different areas, obviously, where we use our communication. And then one sort of final area maybe that we do work with that people might not or know about as much would be working with people who have had changes to their voice. Again, it can happen as part of an acquired brain injury, but certainly there are other people who experience voice difficulties due to maybe some sort of change within their voice box or just the way that they've been using their voice, potentially using their voice incorrectly. So there's a whole sort of specialty area of our profession that works specifically with people with changes to their voice quality. So yeah, I think they're sort of the flagship areas of speech and language therapy. But yeah, I'm never really sure whether people kind of realise that there are so many strands to our profession.
Yeah, I don't think they do. I mean, I always use the acronym SALT, and I was just making a note there of the different areas you're talking about to try and come up with something witty and concise. And I'm like, no. So you've got speech and language therapy, swallowing, cognitive communication, kind of social communication, and the voice. There is a whole kind of wide remit there, isn't there? And lots of complexities. And I know when we've worked together as well, it's not just about kind of the voice, but it's engaging the core muscles and the whole posture and the dovetailing in with the physiotherapists on things like that. That's been really interesting for me to see as well.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think there's often been discussions around whether we should change our professional name to try and capture as many things as we can. But as you said, Kate, it's pretty hard to capture it in a name. So yeah, we just need to be better at publicising what we do, I guess.
Yeah. So what was it that drew you towards the kind of neuro rehabilitation speech and language therapy?
Yeah, funnily enough, when I graduated, I firmly believed that I was always going to be an acute care therapist. That was my whole mindset going through my degree and when I graduated. And my first few jobs were within sort of acute hospital settings. But yeah, as I mentioned earlier, being given the opportunity to then step into a vacancy in the neuro rehab unit up here in Newcastle, it just showed me a completely different part of our profession that I probably hadn't necessarily appreciated that we could do and do so well. And I loved it, absolutely loved it. I did enjoy the acute work that I had done. But yeah, I just think with neuro rehabilitation especially, but also especially in that inpatient setting, just the sort of the relationships that you can form, with your patient, with your client and with their families and their friends, kind of struggle to do that within an acute setting. You know, they're in and out within a couple of weeks potentially. And just as we know, the complexities of acquired brain injury clients and the rehab that we deliver, yeah, it really utilizes a lot of your therapeutic skills and your cognitive power to kind of, you know, problem solve and think through, you know, what you're going to do with these clients. And again, obviously with Walker Gate Park being, you know, such a regional unit, again, we had different sort of strands within Walker Gate Park. So you would have your clients who were in prolonged disorders of consciousness. So that was a very different type of client group. You would have sort of your cognitive communication clients. You would have maybe some of your behavioural clients on the neurobehavioural unit. So again, there was a really good variety within that inpatient setting as well. So kind of fell into it initially. But yeah, once I was there, absolutely loved it and have never looked back. There's been periods of time. So when I was at Durham at Darlington, there was a period of time there where they were potentially going to ask me to cover the acute wards for a fairly lengthy period of time. But I put up a pretty strong argument to suggest that I really would like to stay doing rehab because that's definitely the sort of person I am these days. So
that's great.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Thanks for that, Matt. That's really helpful, really interesting. Just developing the discussion in terms of the MDTs, the multidisciplinary teams, which we set up in collaboration with case managers and other healthcare professionals, along with the lawyers in cases where acquired brain injury follows on from trauma and there's a personal injury claim arising from the trauma. Could you just talk to us in a little detail about your role as a speech and language therapist, if that's the right description nowadays, and how you fit within the MDT? How do you work alongside your fellow therapists and case manager and the lawyers?
Yeah, I mean, Kate's already sort of mentioned that, you know, the aspects of work that we do, we cross over quite a lot. And I think it's the same with most therapies. So, you know, certainly the interventions that we offer as speech and language therapists does have that crossover with the other disciplines within the MDT. And actually that just enables, you know, a really good opportunity to work on clinical areas in a really joint fashion, but bringing slightly different approaches to tackling that clinical problem. So yeah, so Kate flagged up before around sort of if we're working with someone who is needing to work on their sort of their breath support and their breath control to help with their voice or with their speech production, then yeah, we generally work alongside physio to look at posture and sort of see what we can be doing within each other's sessions. From a swallowing perspective, when we're working with people with swallowing difficulties, again, we would be teaming up with physiotherapy to look at posture and positioning to get a person in the best posture possible for when they're trying to swallow. But we would also work closely with occupational therapy to sort of see what we could do to try and enhance that person's ability to feed themselves or to independently drink from a cup. Because again, we find it's better when someone can do those things themselves rather than being dependent on someone to be feeding them or helping them with a drink. Clients that are looking at sort of maybe returning to work or education, again, because communication plays such a large part of those roles, again, we would work alongside occupational therapy and probably neuropsychology to sort of jointly support and help someone get back to those particular settings. And then we talked earlier about people who might have social communication skills or difficulties with cognitive communication skills. And again, because of that huge crossover between cognition and communication in that area, again, we would work, you know, very, very closely with our neuropsychology colleagues to think about strategies that we could help implement with the client to help them sort of get over some of those social communication difficulties and just thinking about ways to facilitate the most effective and appropriate communication that they can do when they're out and about socializing. So yeah, I think, you know, we work really jointly with so many of the other disciplines within the MDT and actually really value it. And, you know, I don't think we can achieve what we want to achieve without working closely with other professions within the MDT. So I kind of guess that's where I see speech and language therapy fitting in, is very much working very jointly with other disciplines. I guess for those clients who have significant communication difficulties and, you know, really struggle to communicate what they're trying to convey, another role that we would often have within the MDT is probably facilitating clients' communication within other therapy sessions, or if they're needing to have a complex discussion with their case manager about something. So, you know, so supporting a client's communication in those scenarios, but also educating and training up the MDT to make sure that they are, you know, using as many strategies and techniques to try and facilitate communication as best they can when they're communicating with a client with particularly significant communication difficulties. Yeah.
Two things coming through quite clearly for me there, Matt. The first is the importance of effective teamwork. Otherwise, the outcomes are going to be nowhere near as good as they should be or could be. But also the fundamental importance of communication, not just between the MDT members, but as a means of actually facilitating rehabilitation. Without the ability to communicate, the sense of isolation and lack of engagement with the rest of life, that must be really very, very difficult.
Yeah, absolutely. That's sort of one of the biggest negative impacts of someone with a communication difficulty is that sense of isolation, sense of being very dependent on other people. And yeah, I always kind of think, you know, if we all tried to, you know, spend a whole day where we couldn't, you know, communicate verbally or could barely communicate, you know, all the things that we want to try and communicate within a 24-hour period. Yeah, I think, you know, we would experience it ourselves to see what sort of a negative impact it can have on your life. As you say, it's a fundamental thing that we probably take for granted at times.
Absolutely.
I suppose that must have impacted quite a lot of your clients during COVID as well, because obviously that face-to-face contact that they would ordinarily have had, and that ability for people to kind of ask them to repeat themselves or to pick up on body language more was probably eroded by the fact that it was more phone calls or video calls, I suppose.
Yeah, definitely. You know, we pick up so much from each other in terms of, yeah, our nonverbal communication and our nonverbal cues. Obviously, Zoom calls and things like that are a little bit easier, but yeah, phone calls especially are difficult to pick up on everything that someone's sort of maybe potentially conveying when they're communicating. But yeah, you know, the face-to-face contact, yeah, is pretty crucial when you're trying to communicate with someone, even just to get that sense of connection and sort of warmth and human contact and all that sort of stuff. So yeah, I can certainly see why the majority of our clients said that they had enough of remote working and were very keen to get back to face-to-face stuff when we could.
Yeah. And I suppose we've talked about the passage of time, but one of the things that I think has kind of crept into our everyday life a bit more is technology, isn't it? And it's something that I know my clients, obviously we think nothing now of, I'm trying to think what's in the room before I say, but nothing of saying just, oh, Alexa, play the radio or add this to the shopping list. And there's some really good tech available, especially for people with memory issues or cognitive issues like lists and stuff. But there are real issues, I think, in how they work for people with difficulties in speech. So is that something that you've always had to kind of maybe work with OTs on, looking at what tech's available and what works well, and then working with clients on how to utilize it?
Yeah, definitely. So yeah, I guess when we were talking about the sort of joint working that we often do, yeah, that's another huge area. So yeah, looking at using technology to enhance communication. Again, we would work, yeah, as you say, work very closely with OT in terms of looking at access to devices, potentially looking at mounting if it needs to be mounted on a wheelchair. Again, thankfully, we have got some good statutory services within the area. So we have got the Regional Communication Aid Service that we can sometimes link clients in with when we need to as well. But yeah, there's such a diverse market when it comes to sort of communication aids and the types of technology that you can use. Yeah, you do need quite a few heads to be put together to work out what would be the best option for a client. But then it's also then trying to encourage the client to use them. A lot of clients are sort of sometimes a little bit resistive to using technology to sort of facilitate their communication, because it's very different, isn't it? It's a very different method of communication. So yeah, there's a lot of work that needs to be done to sort of encourage them and show them how it can actually enhance their communication. So, you know, had a client just this morning where we were trying to get her to use her iPad to just simply introduce herself rather than relying on her support workers to say, this is such and such. But even that sort of little simple sort of communication task, our client was, you know, really anxious and really wary about, you know, just hitting one button to say, my name is, you kind of sometimes, you know, forget how client needs to have a fair mind shift to kind of embrace that different option for communicating.
And thinking back to the MDT and your work with the others, how would you say that the lawyers fit into that MDT for you? And is there anything that you want from us to make your life easier?
Yeah, I guess I think from my perspective, I kind of see the role of lawyers within the MDT and within the processes kind of being there to sort of make sure that we're providing good evidence to sort of justify our ongoing rehab. So in terms of what our goals are, what, you know, how things are going from an outcome measure perspective. So I kind of see the role as gathering evidence to then help justify ongoing funding. So getting sort of regular interim payments to support a client's ongoing rehab journey, but also then conveying that information in a really effective way. So, you know, I don't know, I guess I almost see it as a sort of kind of fighting the corner of the rehab team. You know, we can demonstrate what we're doing and what we're trying to achieve and how we're achieving it. You know, we don't have that dialogue with the people who are then responsible to fund interim payments. So I guess we're very reliant on having, you know, great lawyers to effectively put that message across. And that's where I think it's really important that the clients are represented by very experienced personal injury lawyers who have that understanding and knowledge of the rehab process and know how to present that information in the most effective way possible. So I think, in terms of sort of thinking if there was anything else that I would need from a lawyer, I think we're pretty blessed to have some great lawyers around in our region especially. So I think just knowing that we can use them to put our side of things across in the most effective way.
Matt, you touched on the concept of goal setting when you were talking about the role of the lawyer within the MDT and the importance to the lawyers of understanding that process. Could you just elaborate on that and just explain how you set about setting goals and perhaps more importantly, how you measure progress against those goals? I guess the question is, what does good look like?
I mean, from a goal setting perspective, you know, for me, good looks like when there is true interdisciplinary working. So we touched upon it before, you know, from a speech and language therapist, I love doing joint working and know that joint working is the way forward to achieving the best outcome for our clients. So for an MDT to be truly sort of working in a really interdisciplinary way, that to me is what good rehab is all about. So not having people working in really isolated ways, everyone, you know, joining together. So kind of getting that really good balance between sort of respecting people's professional skills and sort of, you know, professional boundaries to a degree, but also then having some freedom to work creatively with other members of the MDT and probably pushing those boundaries just a little bit because there is that crossover and there needs to be that sort of interdisciplinary way of working. So then from a goal setting perspective, I think rehab works at its best when we have really good interdisciplinary goals. So again, you know, the whole MDT getting together and thinking about some of those interdisciplinary goals. At the end of the day, goal setting is all around, you know, what the client is hoping to achieve. So from an individual perspective, I would always be sort of negotiating some goals with my client on an individual level, sort of based on, you know, what difficulties they're having, what they would hope to achieve, you know, in terms of where we're trying to get to in terms of recovery from those difficulties. So doing that on an individual level, but then bringing that to the MDT and seeing how we can frame that within sort of more broader interdisciplinary goals. So again, you know, if someone's got communication difficulties, you know, yes, I'm going to have some sort of quite specific speech and language therapy goals and probably more sort of short-term goals and medium-term goals, but you know, the big long-term goals are going to fit into sort of more broader umbrellas. So, you know, is it getting back to work? Is it getting a girlfriend or a boyfriend? Is it getting back to school? So those sort of bigger, broader goals that all of the different disciplines then feed into and then obviously have to work together in a really joined up way to achieve those goals. So it's never forgetting that the goal setting needs to be negotiated with the client and agreed by the client. That's the fundamental aspect of good goal setting. So in terms of outcome measures and then sort of ascertaining whether we are achieving what we're doing, obviously, you know, simply achieving goals is one level of outcome measure. So are we achieving the goals that we're setting with our clients? But then we also have a range of sort of formal outcome measures that we can potentially use with clients. So some of the common ones are called the FIM-FAM or the Mayo Portland. Are some of the two key kind of multidisciplinary, interdisciplinary outcome measure tools that we tend to use with clients. Sometimes they're not always as sensitive as you would like them to be. I do sometimes think that, you know, some of these outcome measure tools are great, but actually sometimes they're not always 100% sensitive to indicate some positive change with a client. So that's why I think you need to view goal achievement alongside sort of more formal outcome measures to demonstrate the positive impact that you're having with your rehab with your client.
From the legal perspective, that's really helpful. It gets back to your comment earlier about providing the evidential basis for presenting the claim. So we can, with confidence, proceed with the litigation and say, this is what good rehabilitation looks like. This is what we can achieve with the right funding in place. And certainly from my perspective, and I'm sure Kate's as well, our approach has always been, it's not just about the money, it's about what the money can actually achieve and what it gets you in terms of maximising the rehabilitation opportunities and getting that client back as close as possible to where they were before the accident.
Absolutely, absolutely.
We've talked there about what good looks like and obviously the kind of cohesive communication within the MDT. What would you say some of the common challenges are that you face within the MDT in your role?
Yeah, I think, as we said, communication within the team is crucial. You know, I still sometimes think that sometimes communication within the team and probably access to sort of real-time updates about, you know, any particular client issues that might be happening within a particular day or within a particular week, you know, I think sometimes it can still be a little bit slower than you would like it to be. And, you know, all the MDTs I work in, you know, work very hard to communicate as well as they can do. But I think there are still times where it's just that little bit slower than you would maybe like. You know, by no means is it sort of overly restrictive in the way that we, you know, that we still work with our clients. But yeah, I was thinking the other day, and it's actually something I often think about, you know, it would be just great if there was a way that we could gather all of the MDT record entries on it. It's really hard because obviously there's, you know, different providers and sort of different therapists are often sort of either working for themselves. So I know it's difficult and there would be so many logistical and procedural challenges to do it. But in an ideal world, it would be just great if you just had really quick access to everyone's records within the MDT. Something to think about. But I guess with COVID, and the fact that we obviously moved to telehealth and all of our meetings moved remotely, actually remote meetings have still, for the most part, still remained. So a lot of our sort of client-based meetings are still done remotely. And actually, because that's a really cost-effective way of meeting up and getting the MDT together, I actually think we probably now meet more regularly because we can do it remotely. That's definitely helped that flow of communication. And it sort of enables those really crucial discussions around sort of any particular client issues that are happening, planning your joint therapies, thinking about your goals, completing your outcome measures. So, yeah, I still argue that I think we could potentially meet even more regularly. I'm a huge fan of really regularly getting the team together to just touch base and to work out where things are and where things are going. But again, knowing that you need to balance that out from a cost perspective as well. But yeah, for me, that's probably one of the bigger challenges is sort of that really quick access sometimes to communication or to other disciplines' records. So yeah, definitely something we need to put our heads together with and see if we can come up with something.
When you started to say it, I was thinking, I wish we could all just put notes on one system and even a kind of almost update with non-privileged things from the lawyers as well, just with a kind of, this is what's happening and appointments coming up, that kind of thing. But things can change so quickly, can't they?
Yeah, they can. They can. And you know, as I said before, you know, we all work very hard to communicate as quickly and efficiently as we can. And certainly, if there's a huge issue with a particular client, you know, that communication does kick in really well. And you know, and this is where case managers are really, really crucial in terms of sort of pulling things together and sharing information. So again, a client's going to be in a much better position if they've got a really good and experienced case manager behind them to sort of coordinate all that sort of behind the scenes stuff and facilitate good communication within the MDT. But yeah, at some point, some point in the future, we'll have a single point of access of information.
Well, perhaps we can collectively set that as a goal for ourselves.
There we go. Yeah, I like it. I like it.
So, Matt, we've had some really good insight into the role of the SALT and how you interact with fellow NDT members. Looking at it from the litigation perspective again, we know that the litigation, the court process is very stressful for our clients, and it's a very difficult and demanding process for them to undergo. Do you see any issues between the litigation process and the rehabilitation process? Are there any tensions or perhaps even conflicts between what are parallel processes, but there is inevitably quite a lot of overlap as well?
I mean, I think you touched upon it there anyway, Mark, in terms of the litigation process for our actual clients is, it's a challenge. Like, it, you know, I know that a lot of clients can find it quite overwhelming, intrusive at times with all the sort of appointments and experts that need to come in and sort of maybe constantly feeling like they're under the microscope. So I don't think the tension is necessarily between the litigation and sort of the legal team and the MDT. I think it's just how the litigation process plays out for our clients that then can potentially get them to a point where they do feel too overwhelmed, and then they certainly find it a lot harder to engage in their rehab. And, you know, I think another very common source of frustration for a lot of our clients, and I know it's an exceptionally complex area, I know there's no simple solution to it, but a lot of our clients, I find, just get to a point where they feel like they have a sense of not being in control. They feel like they just don't feel like they're in control of the whole situation. And a lot of the time that almost comes down to sort of financial control as well. You know, I think a lot of my clients get to a point where they get very frustrated around their lack of control over finances. Understandably, that they don't have that control, because we know the whole issues around capacity and capacity to manage finances. But yeah, certainly I've experienced, even just within this last sort of 6 months, several clients getting to the point where they're so frustrated by that particular element that then they will look to see, well, what can they control? And actually one thing they can control is say, well, I don't want to do therapy. I don't want my therapist to come in anymore. So they sort of almost look to see what they can control, because there's elements that they really want to control, but they can't. You know, I know there's no sort of easy solution, but it is maybe something that we do need to think about a little bit more. It's not an easy journey. It's not an easy journey through the medico-legal process for them. You know, I know I would struggle. I would struggle if I was in their shoes. So I guess it's trying to think about how, are there ways that we can do things slightly differently to try and ease some of those frustrations? I know certainly for some of our clients, we've used rehab holidays, or, you know, every 6 to 8 weeks, the client will have a week off from rehab, from, you know, potentially even the litigation process, and just having a bit of space and a bit of time. And actually that works really well, but it's certainly not something that we automatically have done with, you know, it doesn't automatically get done with every single client I work with. So maybe that's something we need to kind of do more regularly to try and help them not feel so overwhelmed with everything. Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I don't know how, don't know whether you guys as the legal team sort of, you know, I'm sure you guys pick up on client frustrations and how they find it very difficult to keep going through the process, and, you know, whether it's something that we can all put our heads together and think about how we can maybe ease some of those bottlenecks that happen every so often.
Yeah. Yeah, as you say, like, touch wood, hopefully we won't be in the position of having to find out, but I've no idea how I would cope with it. And some rehab packages are so intensive, it's almost akin to work. And the idea that you mentioned there of a kind of holiday from the rehab and the litigation seems like a really good one to me. If we were thinking it akin to being at work, then after 6 or 8 weeks, you'd be probably ready for a little break and a bit of downtime. And it's all about pacing, I suppose, isn't it? And liaising with the rest of the therapists and the case managers about that. The other thing I've seen done quite well is, again, subject to funds, so kind of very case dependent, but where the deputies are able to give the client more of a budget and more autonomy on kind of doing that, so that there's a feeling of power and control still, and the ability to be more in charge of things. for me, if someone's not got capacity, it's not about excluding them from the process. They might have got a litigation friend in place, but it's still their claim and they are the heart and centre of it. So it's about involving them as much as possible in the right way,
yeah.
Making sure that information's given to them as appropriate and allowing them to still feel very much part of the process wherever possible.
Yeah. And again, you know, I appreciate, you know, we all appreciate that there's lots of complexities and things that you need to consider in terms of the client's own capacity to handle those sorts of discussions and be able to, you know, be engaged with those discussions. But yeah, as I said, you know, there's potentially not an easy solution, but maybe, you know, maybe the idea of a rehab break just needs to almost be a standard thing that we, mm-hmm. you know, again, we know that some of our clients probably don't always have the insight to know that they're going to get to that point of feeling really overwhelmed, that it all gets a bit too much. So, you know, maybe as MDTs, we need to preempt that a little bit better and actually have that as a standard thing that, you know, clients have a week off every sort of 8 weeks. Like you said before, you know, as a workforce, we take annual leave and we sometimes say to our clients that actually their rehab is like their job at the moment. You know, this is your job. You know, your job mm-hmm. is to do your rehab and to get better and to recover. So if it's their job, then yeah, they should be having some annual leave as well. So yeah, something to think about. I think the other mm-hmm. thing around, again, it's not necessarily attention, but and we talked about before about the importance of having, you know, a good personal injury lawyer to make sure that those interim payments are sort of coming through consistently and regularly to keep sort of rehab going and to fund whatever sort of might be needed for rehab. But you know, again, we all know that we have cases where sometimes that doesn't happen. So there's either a hold up on interim payments or, and again, I don't always know all the ins and outs as to why that happens. But from a rehab team and from an MDT perspective, you know, sometimes it can be a little bit frustrating if that sort of regular interim payment isn't coming through and you know, there might be a hold up for purchasing a particular piece of equipment, or in one case, not through you guys, but there was, you know, huge issues with interim funds coming through, and it got to the point where actually rehab actually had to almost stop, or we were sort of told that we had to sort of strip things right down. And then again, that wasn't great, especially, you know, where that person was at in their rehab journey. They were at a really crucial point to then be told that actually, you know, the interim payments aren't coming through. We can't fund as much rehab as you guys are recommending at the moment. So again, the importance of having a really good and experienced personal injury lawyer to really, you know, get that message across that interim funds need to be there to keep that yeah. rehab process going.
And the communication to liaise with you guys to perhaps try to let you know what, if there are issues, they are and what the timescales involved are, so that you can then yeah. pitch it earlier. Because I think I've been on ones before where they've almost said, well, it's better to not start than to start and then stop. And that's a call for you as therapists to make, yeah. but you can only make that with the information that you've got, haven't you? So,
yeah.
But no. Yeah. We've obviously talked a lot about challenges and tensions and everything else. So let's finish on something a little bit happier and better. So what would you say your proudest achievement so far has been?
As a speech therapist, my proudest achievement? I mean, there's two I can think of. One's more neuro rehab related, so I'll go with the neuro rehab one. So it was actually working with a client with an acquired brain injury who had been nil by mouth, so I hadn't been eating and drinking for, I would say it was a good couple of years since his injury. And yeah, he had some speech and language therapy off and on, but yeah, not to the level that he kind of actually needed. So again, thankfully he had a medico-legal claim behind him. So yeah, I was able to get involved and we accessed lots of private swallowing examinations for him, which he hadn't had prior to my involvement. So being able to actually work out exactly what was happening with his swallowing was pretty crucial. So we were then able to, yeah, implement a pretty intensive swallow rehab program. It took a long time. And again, this is where, you know, I guess people need to appreciate that rehab can take a long time. You know, potentially, I think if he was relying on statutory services, they would have presumably considered mm-hmm. that he would have plateaued. There was potentially no scope there, but yeah, we plugged away at it, and you know, bless him, he did a lot of hard work, and we gradually got him onto different consistencies and different drink consistencies, and ultimately he got back to eating and drinking normally. He got yeah. his peg removed, which was, you know, one of the happiest days of his lives.
Yeah,
it was one of his biggest goals was to get his feeding tube removed. So we celebrated accordingly and had a chicken parmo. At
I've never had one.
You've never had one? Wow.
No, I need
it. It was my first proper chicken parmo. We have a chicken parma in Australia, but that we could do a whole different podcast about that. So yes, we celebrated at his local pub with his favourite meal. So to feel like we had got someone who had not been eating and drinking for 2 years back to eating and drinking normally and enjoying all the things that we enjoy when we eat and drink, and to get his feeding tube out. Yeah, I was pretty proud of that one.
No, that's fantastic. I can totally understand why you would be. I'll probably have to quiz you later about what the other achievement is as well, though. Otherwise, I'll be thinking about it forever. No, that's great to hear. And as you say, that rehab's taken a long time, but he was in that position of not eating and drinking for an awful long time, and you wouldn't expect that change overnight. But the fact that you and he have both put that work in is tremendous, because that's so much enjoyment from being able to go out in that social context, like you say, down the pub, you know, just have a drink with friends, that I think a lot of us would just absolutely take for granted that's been returned to
it. I mean, absolutely. Food and drink, again, you know, forms such a large part of lots of things that we do, you know, from a social perspective and a celebratory perspective. So yeah, food and drink's pretty much always there in the background, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's awesome, great. Matt. Well, Matt, I think Australia's loss is the Northeast's gain, and we look forward to working with you on behalf of our clients for many more years to come. Thank you so much.
That's brilliant. Thank you very much. Thanks for inviting me along.
Thanks very much to all of you. Very much enjoyed listening to that. Very quickly for me, we release our webinars, podcasts and blogs on a regular basis, all of which can be found on our website, www.sintons.co.uk, should you wish to take a look. And obviously that includes all episodes of this podcast series. You can also follow the Neurotrauma team on Twitter, two accounts, at Sintons Neuro and also at Sintons PI. If you'd like to discuss anything our speakers have raised today further, please don't hesitate to get in touch with them. Their contact details can be found on their respective websites and also via their LinkedIn profiles. We hope you've enjoyed listening to them as much as we have enjoyed recording them, and that they've been beneficial and added value to you. Thank you once again for listening. Stay safe, everyone, and we'll speak to you soon. Thank you.